Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is June the 2nd, 2018, Saturday, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400. I got so many telephone numbers in my brain, they all begin with 254.
Yeah.
But just it's 254.
It's like they gave that to a whole area or something.
Right. 254-773-1400 if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question or something. Anything economic or to do with investing, and we'll talk about it. If you call and ask about something to do with professional sports, we'd have to give you alternate facts, so we won't do it. Anyway.
Or we could just make them up.
And the Italian crisis came and went like a blaze of glory. The other thing that happened this week was the unemployment rate dropped to 3.8%. I said there was a brief period of time in the year 2000, just before the 2000 to 2002 ancient history, pretty severe recession, 50% drop in the stock market, when we got down to 3.8%. Before that, the last time we were in, we were at 3.8, and I may be wrong on the, it was either 1960s or 1950s. What did I say in the letter? It was 1956, I think it was.
I can look.
But it was a long, long time ago, and it's been a long, long time since we have been in a position where we had 3.8% unemployment.
1969.
1969. That was,
yeah, the wrong decade.
Yeah, well, before that, it was 1956. I think that's what it was. It
okay.
was, but 1969. And we, this is about as good as it gets as far as unemployment. Now, can it go lower? Yes. Can it go lower without generating inflation? That's going to be one of the big questions that we run into. Can it go lower without causing economic disruptions? That's another big question we're going to run into. Odds, I mean, historically, and the theory suggests that what happens is at this point is wages start up and automation begins to intercede because it's too expensive to employ people. But we're in a different economy now. We're in a global economy. Despite the tariff threats and the threats of trade wars, and actually the trade wars are getting started now, one side, our side, is firing all its cannons. Or not all of its cannons.
A lot of its cannons.
The fact is that there's a lot of things done in the United States that could be done somewhere else. Anytime somebody answers the phone, they can be somewhere else or they can be in the United States. Several times this week, I called for technical support on various things, and I talked to people in the United States who spoke English very well and knew what they were doing and were able to immediately communicate with other departments in their company and get something straightened out. So nothing says that those jobs can't be moved to India or China, where there are actually more English speakers in China than there are in the United States. So would it involve some expense in moving those things overseas? Yeah. But on the other hand, if you can't find anybody to do the job here, then you need to go find somebody to do the job someplace else. Now, one of the ironies, of course, that comes out with lower unemployment rates is we now have fewer people unemployed than we have job openings, which means if somehow miraculously we could get everybody who's unemployed and looking for work into a position where they lived in the right place and had the right skills, we still wouldn't have enough people to get the job done in the United States. That's what we call hitting capacity. That means we are going to start to see bottlenecks in the economy. We're going to start to see problems. Again, though, this is a more global economy than we've ever had before. So we conceivably could see those.
I'm sure I understand.
You've got a phone talking to you.
I have a phone talking to me?
Yeah. She's not sure that she understands.
Yes, indeed. Siri was decided that instead of just talking on the radio, I would talk to her.
She would make a good speech at any economics conference.
So
just,
I'm just
say that repeatedly.
Turn her off.
How do you feel about the tariffs? I'm not sure I understand.
So, to say that there's a lot of interesting things going on is an understatement. To say that the economy is rolling along, hitting on all cylinders, and is running at full speed is
that
the
is
truth.
The absolute truth. We have an economy that is running better, hotter, with more potential for profits for a lot of people than we've seen in my lifetime.
And there's a peculiarity here, and we've talked about this before. We've talked about it in the newsletter. The tax cuts took effect at the beginning of the year, but it takes a while for them to show up in economic activity, and it's starting to show. And I think probably when the second quarter comes in with a...
We had a revised first quarter GDP down to 2.1 right. from 2.2, but we're thinking maybe this quarter mm-hmm. may be pretty big.
Could see the threes, and this will be largely because of the tax cut. So the short-term effect of the tax cut would be to stimulate the economy, and we should start to see that in the second quarter, but it really will come on. There's a lag, and economists try to estimate what the lag is, but the third and fourth quarters of this year is when we will really see the effect of the tax cut hitting. So I would expect to see some unusually high economic activity in the United States, GDP up 3-point-something percent perhaps for the entire year. That's optimistic, but I think it may happen. But the problem is the serious economic analytical folks like Moody's Analytics, which tends to get things right, and other and right. academics around the world, pretty much are in agreement that the capacity of the United States to grow long-term right now is about 1.8% a year.
And just to fill this in, I've said this before on the air, this is one of those truisms in economics. The growth of any company, a country, company, doesn't matter, country specifically, comes down to two factors, demographics and productivity.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a growing nation, you've got more people being born than are dying.
Or
more immigration coming in.
In other words, you've got a growing population.
You've got, of that demographic, you've got a very educated workforce. And productivity is the effect of education. So if you've got productivity growth and population growth going on at the same time, you're going to have a growing economy. There's just no way around that. I mean, you can kill it, you can tax it into oblivion, but that will take down productivity. So if those two things are going well, you have a growing economy. When we say capacity, it means that we are at the edge of demographics. The only available route to continue growth, if we do not have more immigration or more babies, is to exponentially increase our productivity, whether through robotics or AI or whatever. But we're not prepared to do that right now. We don't have all the technology in place. It's not market ready. Because it's not market ready, we're running into the edge of our demographics. The productivity is growing very slowly. Part of the reason why productivity grows very slowly in high hiring times is because you hire someone that, and they're not going to know how to do what you want them to do yet. And sometimes you got to take your highest productivity people off of the product line to get them to train the people that you want to be more productive, which mm-hmm. lowers productivity. Hopefully it leads to higher productivity later, and that may be what we're seeing in the second quarter with the tax cuts. And hopefully if we start seeing productivity numbers go up, I'll push my estimate out for the recession by at least another quarter. But as it is, I'm thinking late 2019, just because you can't go faster than the fastest you can go. And if you stay at that level for a long time, you're just going to exhaust yourself.
And, you know, the economy cannot grow faster than its slowest portion.
Right.
And we've got some backlog that we can work our way through. There's certain things that we can burn through and continue to grow faster than we can than a sustainable rate. But one of the...
We've got to get an award for something here. To say all this good stuff about the economy in the most pessimistic way possible.
Well, that's why it's called the dismal science.
Right. It is great right now, and we are both of the opinion that the economy is beautiful at the moment, but we see some dangers ahead.
In the 1991 recession, we were counting trucks.
Yeah.
1990-something.
It wasn't 91. It was...
98.
98, and then again in 2002.
So... We were counting trucks on the highway, which, by the way, is almost irrelevant now because we saw the number of trucks has grown exponentially.
It's
you almost
huge
can't
amounts.
Count them. And we were saying in the middle of this, of the, well, it was 2002 recession and other recessions, we have said this ain't so bad. It's, we're coming back.
We can see the trucks.
We're optimistic.
Being
this is an
this is an
investment opportunity. We're going to come back like gangbusters. We're not going to fall off the edge of the cliff. And people were saying we were too optimistic. And of course, then we did come back. As a matter of fact, I was on Bloomberg
in
Bloomberg Television in 2002, and I said, "Well, this is the bottom." And he said, "Well, what if it's different this time?" And I said, "That's the proof that it's the bottom." Because that's what people say at the top, and that's what they say at the bottom. What if it's different this time? And you just said it. So that is further evidence that we're, this I think was in August of 2002, which was in fact the bottom of the market. And so we're not being unduly pessimistic here. We're simply saying that things are about as good as it's going, as they can get. The market is reflecting the same attitude that we have because it's not rising despite the fact in the first quarter we had record earnings by S&P 500 companies. The price-to-earnings ratio, which was up around the forward price-to-earnings ratio, which was up about 22 at one point, is now down to 16.7, I think it is. And what does that mean? That means that the stock market, based, if we say the stock market is priced according to the earnings of the companies in the S&P 500, their profits is now roughly, 3% lower than it was at the beginning of the year. Even though it's up a little bit, the point is earnings have gone up very substantially. And the stock market has actually down from where it was at the end of January. And why is the stock market down if corporate earnings are up? Well, because they're worried about some things coming down the road, just like we are. They're not determined. They haven't determined. The traders and the investors across the board have not determined that it's going to be a horrific crisis and the world's going to come to an end or anything to that effect. But they are being cautious because they're seeing a lot of signs that historically indicate that we've got a slowdown coming in the future. So we're warning you that, while personally, I think, and I think Jake may agree with me, I don't know, that the stock market will be higher at the end of the year than it is today. It'll have a gain for the year. There's certainly no guarantee that's going to happen, and there is a very high probability that I say 2020, he says 2019, sometime in that time frame.
I'd say late 2019.
We're going to get what's called a cyclical recession. Now, a cyclical recession is very, very different from the thing we had in 2007 through 2009, which was a secular depression, or secular recession. Secular recessions are really bad. They're really nasty. Things blow up, and there's a threat to the total socioeconomic system. Cyclical recessions are just things. They're called supply recessions. People build up, have made more stuff than they can sell. At some point, the consumer, which is the vast majority of our economic activity, 70-some percent of our economic activity in the United States is the consumer buying things and not reselling them, will tap out their credit cards and they will start to feel uncomfortable about spending more money and they will stop spending money. But meanwhile, manufacturers and retailers have ordered a bunch of stuff to sell to them in the following several months.
Because they've been buying so much.
And then they wind up with too much stuff, and the manufacturers wind up manufacturing too much stuff, and they have to start laying people off because they got more stuff than they can sell. And we work our way through that. Average time period to work our way through that is 18 months. Sometimes it's quicker, sometimes it's longer. We're due for one. We now have the longest period in since we've been keeping records, which is a long time, of job growth. We have 92 months, I think it is. It's either 90 or 92 months of continuous, every month for the past, I think it's 92 months, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, we have had more people hired than laid off in the United States, and it's been consistent. And we're consistently, month after month after month, net hiring more people than we're producing new workers in the economy. Now, where are these workers coming from? Doggone good question, because the long-term unemployed rate is staying about the same. The underemployed rate is staying about the same. the workforce participation rate is staying about the same.
It's 92.
All these numbers are staying about the same. And yet we wind up hiring roughly 200,000 people a month more than are getting laid off. Very few people are getting laid off. And there's just, believe me, a lot of people are asking questions. Where are all these darn people coming from? One theory, by the way, is they're coming out of Puerto Rico.
That's happening because the population drop in Puerto Rico is very real.
The hurricane that went through Puerto Rico apparently did a lot more damage and killed a lot more people than was initially reported. We went from 64 to around 2,000.
Yeah. As far as deaths
are concerned, by the time, and the problem goes, of course, and still is true, is there's sections, pretty good sized sections of Puerto Rico, where there's still no power and no telephone. And so we don't know who died there, unless somebody physically drives in carrying lots of cans of gasoline so that they can refuel their own vehicle and says, how many people died here?
And then, they're still boarded up, powerless, no roads, and a lot. I mean, this is part of the United States, and we have not made it a national priority to get down there and fix it.
Right.
If this were in New Orleans, then there would be a national outcry about the slowness in getting help and people back to work. Puerto Rico is in a world of hurt. It's really, really painful
this
right now.
May or may not be an accurate statement. It was reported by people in the White House, anonymous people reporting, saying to newspapers, which makes it may or may not be true, that the president said, look, if they wanted full help from the United States, they'd become a state. Since they want their independence and they want to have being part of the United States without being part of the United States, and they want all the advantages and none of the costs, they can take care of themselves.
Number is closer to 5,000.
5,000?
Yeah.
Killed?
Yeah.
And, it's one of those things, and there's basically the place is emptying out. You can probably get some pretty cheap real estate down there right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's true also in the Virgin Isles. We've got clients down there, and many of the schools have been shut down from damage. And so many schools are running multiple schools worth of kids at different times during the day at the same school.
Mm-hmm. And there's just not the money that historically has been there. The Congress would pass something and the president would push for it and they'd have an emergency declarations.
It just hasn't happened.
And we'd go down and fix the islands in the Caribbean, and we have elected not to do that this time. And
that's
just
a decision that we've made at this point. And whether or not that is a requirement that the federal government do, it's basically up to the electorate. And it seems like the electorate seem pretty comfortable with Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Isles just staying as they are.
And, it's
that may be a good thing long term. This is one of those things that we complain about long term, is that people keep building on sites that keep getting destroyed from floods or hurricanes. It's just a really common occurrence to have things completely demolished there, and then the federal government steps in and gives them a bunch of money to rebuild. Well, this may be an opportunity to step in and say, how do we build Puerto Rico in a way that's not going to get destroyed again? Or the same with the Virgin Isles. We're not really using that opportunity either. We're just saying, we're not saying anything. It's pretty quiet in the news, actually. There's really nothing out there about Puerto Rico. You don't hear about it, except it's happening. Huge numbers of American citizens have left Puerto Rico and come to the United States.
And that is one, since we don't have the good statistics, since a U.S. citizen in Puerto Rico, leaving Puerto Rico and coming to the United States is not recorded by the... as an immigration event. Nobody knows how many people. Right now, they really don't know. There's just guesses as to how many people are leaving Puerto Rico and coming to the United States. And since the majority of people in Puerto Rico are quite conversant and they're reasonably well-educated, and they are quite conversant in English, they can come to the United States and get jobs without any problem at all. They're just a U.S. citizen getting a job. And that is the one explanation for where all these extra people are coming from, to that we keep hiring 232 people, 230,000 amazing numbers of people, every month, far more than we're producing. We're producing about 100,000, and I've seen up to 144, but I think it's around 100,000 new workers a month in the United States.
And somehow we're able to hire 200,000+. That means people are coming out of places that they weren't either looking for jobs before, or the place that they were no longer is effectively there. And there's some evidence that people have been leaving the Detroit area in larger amounts, that they stayed and they stayed and they stayed, and then finally they're leaving, that there's just not enough revitalization there, and the job offers elsewhere have been good enough to get them to move. And what you said about there's just not enough people to fill all the jobs that are open right now, it's true.
Another piece of sort of good news, wages from a year ago are up at 2.7%. But month on month, we're seeing the average the last several months running around 0.3%. You know, you can't do the math on that, but it's roughly, that means about a 3.7% growth per year in wages is what we're seeing month on month. 2.7 from 12 months ago. The Federal Reserve has indicated in their minutes that were released that they're willing to see some symmetry. I love that term. What that means is we have seen below average inflation for several years now, and the 2% goal is what the Federal Reserve wants, 2% inflation used by the consumption index. And we've had consumption index running around 1% for quite a while. It's now up to 2, and they have announced that they're willing to see some symmetry. And what that means is they're willing to see it run above 2, up towards 3% in the near future, just to offset the 1% period so they don't overreact to it. There's a 36% chance, if you get the voting among economists and you have the computers crunch the numbers on this and that and the other, that we will see 3 more rate increases by the Federal Reserve this year. It's at 1.5 right now, and it would take it up to 1.75, and then 2, and then 2.25 by the end of the year, if that's true. Going up towards our historic norm of around 3.
We're certainly seeing interest rates come up on houses. The average has gone from a month ago. This is how fast interest rates on houses have gone up right now. From a month ago, the average rate was 4.5%. We're now up to 4.8%, 4.9%.
As a mortgage rate.
As a mortgage rate. 30-year mortgage, fixed mortgage rates with large down payments. So when we're looking at interest rates go up, it's a reality now. We're now moving up above where we've been for more than a decade. And that means be careful in your bond portfolio, because interest rates are going to be going up for a while.
And it's one of those things where this, as the economy accelerates, you'll see interest rates start to rise. And the reason is it's just a law of supply and demand. The more demand there are for loan, the higher interest rates is going to go. And we expect to see that accelerate into the year. And that's one of the reasons the Federal Reserve needs to lift interest rates back to, and I would say 3% to 3.5% is the historic normal interest rate in the Fed rate in the United States.
Right.
And for whatever it's worth, it's a good point to remember that historically, going back through most of the 20th century, the average inflation rate in the United States has been around 3%. Actually, it's a little higher than 3% because we had some double-digit inflation I don't think we're going to get again. But around 3% is the norm for interest rates. 3.5% would be the norm for interest rates, and 3% would be the norm for inflation.
Right. This is something that throughout the recession till now, I've heard a lot of people talking about why should I even go to college? College is, people are that went to college still are looking for work. Throughout the recession, the lowest level of unemployment was for people that went to college, followed by people with some college, followed by high school, and then followed the worst position is if you didn't even graduate high school. It's still there. still exactly the same as that. In fact, during the recession, the peak unemployment for college-educated people was 4.8%. The peak unemployment for less than high school was 14.7%. Mm-hmm. So what we have today, college-educated people, there's a 2.1% unemployment right. rate.
By the way, we also hit the lowest unemployment rate in history. I don't remember what it was, but it was the lowest one in history for women.
Yeah, 3.6. We're at 3.8 for the whole marketplace, and 3.6 for women. And what that says is that women are more hireable than men.
Which is
no big surprise there.
Well, it's a reversal from historic norms. But everything we're saying says the economy is running pretty much at full throttle. All systems are go. The difficulty is, despite what happens on Star Trek, you can't run at 110% or 100% or 200% of capacity.
Well, Scotty would tell you, she can't handle much more of this, Captain.
That's right. And, you know,
dilithium crystals in the economy are coming apart.
And when I was in the Army and we flew helicopters and ran turbine engines, you could run them at full military power, but when you did, you had to log it because it meant the engine life, before you had to tear it down and pull pieces out of it and replace pieces, was shortened because you were running it at a higher power setting.
Yeah, in the Navy, we're talking about flank speed. You know, all ahead flank, that means you are now, if you keep up at this speed, you're going to hit the red zone. You could very, very easily do some damage to your engines. That's where we are right now. We're really going fast, and it's kind of fun.
It is. It is certainly enjoyable, and it is having the question. There's several. I've said this in the newsletter. This is the biggest economic experiment, fiscal economic experiment, since the Great Depression. Basically, the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress have determined that they're going to do certain things financially, fiscally in the United States. We're going to borrow a lot of money, more than we've ever borrowed before outside of wartime. We're going to basically take that borrowed money and give it to everybody in the form of lower taxes. They get to keep more of what they make, so we lower taxes.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to stimulate the heck out of the economy.
And spend more. We're going to spend more at the governmental level.
Right. At the same time, we're going to pass some bills and spend a lot more money. So we're going to have a lot of borrowing and spending, and we're going to do this pretty much at the peak of the economic cycle and see what happens. And, you know, cynically and admittedly, a number of congressmen have stated this openly. The objective is that if the economy is running at full tilt and we have maximum employment and everybody is economically happy, then in November of 2018, the Republicans will not do what historically happens in a midterm election. The whatever party controls the House of Representatives following a presidential election, if it's the same as a president, loses the House of Representatives at the midterm election. And they're trying to beat the odds on that by stimulating the heck out of the economy with basically quoting Bill Clinton. It's the economy, stupid.
He's not the only one that said it. Nixon said
right.
it. And Reagan said it.
So
Clinton said it.
They're making an effort to do this, and it's also out of the White House and out of the Congress, an experiment to say the economists say we should be putting the brakes on right now and paying off the debt. We're going to try running the debt up and punching the accelerator and see what happens, and it's an experiment.
The advice that we give to our clients right now in this really, really great economy that we've got is pay down your debts and build up your savings. Kind of the opposite of what the Congress is doing.
And we have got a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Talking about these tariffs. You know, and it's not the way we've done things for the last, you know, so many years. And
right.
They're dangerous and everything else. Well, Donald Trump's a different animal out there, obviously. It's
absolutely.
And you know, as you mentioned earlier, I think this is just a tactic to get more fair trade, and I think everybody agrees that, you know, fair trade is our tariff equals their tariff, basically, or no tariffs on
right.
both sides.
Well, actually,
we don't have that.
When you get to Europe, there were no tariffs, for instance, on steel that we exported to Europe. And there's still no tariffs on steel we export to Europe.
There's no tariffs on steel we export or import from Mexico or from Canada. We had free trade in many areas. This is kind of the point here. If you measure trade from an American company perspective, it's very different than an American country perspective. If you measure trade at a local level, like where do you live? What city?
Georgetown.
Okay, you're in Georgetown. And there's an Applebee's in Georgetown, and there's an Applebee's in, I don't know, Austin. And you go to an Applebee's in Georgetown for a while, and then you decide to go to the Applebee's in Austin. Georgetown's going to lose some tax revenue from sales tax. But Applebee's not losing revenue. Applebee's is fine. Applebee's has sold you food in both locations. When we're talking about imports and exports from our allies, the majority of that import-export is either through company alliances, partnerships, or
inside a given company.
So when we measure the automobile imports from Mexico, Mexico has no Mexican car companies. There are no companies that produce Mexican cars. There are a lot of American companies there and a very few European companies there. So when we slap a tariff on Mexico, we're slapping a tariff on the United States. This is the issue here. And when you know, the metric that's being used to talk about unfair trade is a metric that goes back to Wilson, to Woodrow Wilson, of here's how we measure trade these days, and it's not accurate.
And the guy who, by the way, set up this trade measuring system that we use today was named Herbert Hoover.
Right.
Yeah, but my point is, yeah, I mean, I keep going back to the term fair trade.
Right.
You know? And we haven't had fair trade. I mean, you know, I know this last batch of steel and aluminum tariffs didn't go on China, but I think that's, you know, there's method to the madness there about trying to get something done with North Korea. So
I don't know. Let me say that the question is not, and in many ways we agree with the stated intent.
Right. We need free trade.
Fair
trade.
And bargaining works. The problem, and this is the thing that a lot of people are very, very concerned about, and there's the market is indicating an assumption that the Trump administration is using this as a negotiating ploy, and they're going to pull the trade back. But here's the problem. It's like we talked about World War One. Nobody wanted World War One. But the various participants that caused the war to get started kept moving troops around and moving trade tariffs around with the intent of causing the other people to back down. And at some point, the people they didn't back down, they started counter-tariffing and counter-moving of troops. And pretty soon you had a full-scale trade war going that was followed by a full-scale shooting war that nobody wanted.
The other piece of this, just a minute. The other piece of this is that we're not targeting these tariffs in a very, you know, almost at all. We've got a broad stroke that's painting everyone as being a cheater.
Everybody being a strategic threat.
Right, a strategic threat. That they somehow you are a threat to our country. When we say that to Canada, that doesn't make any sense. It really, Canada has participated in every war that we fought in the last 100 years. On our side, when they didn't have a strategic interest there, they are, in essence, our default ally unless we make them otherwise. And
yeah, I realize that.
So when we are charging them for this, go ahead.
What do you think the intent of this is, and what do you think the outcome of this is? I think it's going to be positive. I don't think there's going to be a 25% and a 15% tariff. But
well,
I think,
it's
I
already
think
there.
We know the price of steel is up.
Depending on the type, it's already there. The tariff is there.
Pardon me, say again.
No, I mean, I have about as much faith in the price of steel as I do the stock market. You know, if somebody sneezes one time, it goes up. If somebody sneezes a different time, it goes down. You know, I mean, it's fickle. It's
well, our, the point is, you don't buy and you don't have to buy and sell stocks to do business. And we know people that are in the business where they use steel and they manufacture things. We have clients in that position, and they are seeing their cost of doing business rise very substantially, but they can't raise prices. Well, that can go on for a little while.
But they're just going to say, I've got to raise prices. The other piece of it is that there's an inconsistency in that they don't know what their price is going to be. Where they had a fairly reasonable estimate of what their price would be in the next 6 months for any given purchase, now there's a wild fluctuation in prices, which makes it really hard to commit to an order that's 6 months down the road.
And this is all could be just a ploy. The issue is, and again, we have to go by what we know at this point. Now, I said it's an experiment. It may turn out wonderfully. But if, in fact, the Europeans go through with what they have said, which is we will not negotiate while tariffs are in place, and the Trump administration goes through with what they said yesterday, which is if you hit us with counter tariffs on June 20th, we will hit you with more tariffs.
The problem with trade
then
wars...
Then if that happens, we've got a full-fledged trade war going with both sides claiming we will not back down.
The problem with a trade war, when you win a trade war... You the way you measure winning in a trade war is the one that lost the least. The way you win in a fairer trade environment is the one that has the longest term profitable relationships. So where we are is if you can't win a trade war and have more than what you started with. That's the problem, is that if you win a trade war, it's because you didn't lose as much as the other people did. And that is the piece that we keep coming back to. If two companies have to compete on a price, and they're competing hard on a price back and forth because they're direct competitors, neither of them really wins until the other one disappears. And they didn't really win yet because they have a long time to recoup all of the profit that they lost by having that war. Now, that keeps the profits... It keeps the prices down for the people that are buying from those two competitors. That's a good situation going there. When a government steps in and jacks up the prices for everybody, there is a temporary winner, and that is the government, because the revenue from these tariffs goes directly into the government coffers. This is a tax. It is a revenue generation for the United States government. And that's what we have to look at. Well, maybe we won't have to borrow as much if the tariffs bring in a lot of money.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, I'll hang up. Certainly enjoy your program.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. And we have a great deal of hope that this is a new form of negotiation, that the president has a clearly laid out plan. I wish he would explain it.
I don't.
But I don't think that's what it is.
You know, the caller asked a question. What do you think the outcome of this will be? Well, it's one of two outcomes. Either, and the president has said this. I'm not denigrating the president anyway. He said his objective is to win, and that's the outcome is, if the other side backs down, then he wins and he will be satisfied. His intention is to win. He has a constituency, a populist constituency, that says the foreigners are bad, and if they lose face and back down, then he wins. And I think that's the objective here. I don't think there's an economic positive. I don't think anyone can seriously say there's an economics positive to any of this. Even the steelworkers unions and the steel manufacturers are begging him not to put tariffs in against Europe, Canada, and Mexico. Because, by the way, the steel manufacturing industry is all across North America now. So by throwing tariffs on Mexico and Canada, he actually costs the steel manufacturers in the United States money, because as they move products back and forth across the border, they got to pay tariffs.
Yeah.
If Canada turns around and hits us with a 25% tariff, that'll be a 50% cost of moving steel pieces to Canada and back again. Anyway, go ahead. you have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say that my experience in the last quite a few years has been that all of the scrap metal now sold in the United States, old junk cars, old rusty scrap, whatever, where does it go?
Mostly to China.
It all loaded on a freighter and goes to China.
Mm-hmm.
And then they melt it and sell it back to us.
Yeah.
Okay. How is that going to change?
They don't sell it back to us usually.
Well, if Mr. Trump cuts back on EPA regulations, OSHA regulations, et cetera, that has put a lot of steel foundries out of business, how is that going to change?
Well, he can't put huge cuts on the law. The law is pretty clear, and how much he enforces it obviously is open to some question, but even if he doesn't enforce it, somebody can sue the companies because they violated the law, the Clean Air Act. And, you know, Congress would have to change a law for that to be changed significantly. We've done a really good job in the United States of exporting our pollution to China and Mexico. We take, you know, an awful lot of stuff. Well,
I won't
say that because we have record low unemployment right now. So we've got as many people, basically everybody who wants a job and is willing to go get the job can get a job right now.
Well, but you're talking about in the last 2 months. I'm talking about the last 10 years.
Well, in 10 years ago, the entire world had a very high unemployment rate.
Right. Mexico's unemployment rate is far higher than ours.
And they were far more unemployed than we are. But we're talking about actions that are being taken right now, not something that happened 10 years ago. And the issue is a matter of we've got more jobs open in the United States than we have unemployed people. So creating more jobs in the United States doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I'm just saying I have seen Lone Star Steel go out of business. I've seen Anaconda Copper go out of business.
Yeah.
And Alcoa Aluminum go out of business. And why is that?
Because
they went out of business because we're shipping all that stuff to China and they're redoing it and shipping it back.
No. Well, hold on just a minute. You keep saying shipping it back. We import less than 1% of our steel from China. Of the steel that we imported before the tariffs, less than 1% of it came from China.
Well,
China's steel prices affected the rest of the steel, so they had a lot of steel. They were dumping it on other markets, which caused that steel to go down in price. But we're essentially blaming all of the world for China's overproduction of steel, and that's a problem. We have to approach this from a way that makes sense, or we are the inconsistent bad guy. And that's the problem.
Somebody explained the other day that we receive a lot of steel imported from countries that don't have a steel smelter. So is it being sent from China to Indonesia, from Indonesia to America?
Yeah, we just put a really massive fine on Vietnam. Because Vietnam was buying steel from China and immediately selling it to us. Well, there was a big fine, and this was under an Obama-era agreement that you can't dump steel from China into the United States.
Our biggest source of imported steel is Canada, where they have a lot of foundries. So if you want to start with imported steel, it's Canada that's the bad guy, except for the fact that we export more stuff to Canada than we import from Canada. So we have a trade surplus with our biggest source of imported steel. So do you want to punish Canada because they're buying more stuff from us than we're buying from them?
Or that they are being more productive with their steel foundries than we are. They have the same pollution laws. They're actually stricter in Canada than they are here. So if we say the reason why we're not in the steel business is because of pollution or because of the EPA, they've got stricter laws there, and they're able to produce the steel. That means that we just gave up.
And I, by the way, have read 3 stories now in reliable publications that companies wanted to reopen steel plants, or metal creation plants, and they can't find workers. So they can't reopen.
Let me just yield to your greater knowledge because I got to go get ready to do something here in a few minutes.
I think you got to be on the air in a couple of minutes somewhere.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. we'll talk to you later.
All right.
Appreciate the
call. Talk to you later, Con.
Yeah,
we got to do commercials too.
We do. Let's hit the commercials. We'll come back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to call in, the phone number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and we will be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have about 6.5 minutes left in the program today.
Less than that now. And less than even that now.
Okay.
It's like the time keeps draining away.
That happens. It does happen. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. If you got anything to say at the end, we've been talking about tariffs and things of that nature. Basically, the summary is the stock market went up just a little bit this week. It dipped and then it came back and it's wobbling around and it's basically, and I didn't use, when I used the term noise come out of the White House, it's not mine. I mean, it was in Barron's, it was in the Wall Street Journal, it was in the Financial Times. There seems to be on the street this idea that when the White House issues a proclamation, we're going to impose tariffs on somewhere and then imposes the tariffs. The stock market is getting where it ignores that. Now, here's the danger is if it turns out it's not noise, then
it's actual promise, a promise that's going to be delivered on, then there's a problem.
And yet the economy, everything in the economy indicates it is running above capacity. It's running at full throttle.
Inflation looks. I mean, it's there. We're right at the target level 2 months in a row. We're right at the 2% point.
Everything in the economy looks like it's humming. The tax cuts are having their desired stimulative effect. We expect to see the gross domestic product rate come up around in the 3%, maybe even up at 3% areas this year.
At least in the second quarter.
And so what we're seeing is a very, very healthy, strong running economy, but there's some things going on out there that could easily cripple this a year or two from now. That's kind of the summary, I think, isn't it?
And the
market's reflecting there because it's not going up. The price-earnings ratio is dropping.
And the market is fickle, but I think that there is a pretty good consensus right now of we're going to hang around. It's basically what happened during the entire election season. The entire election season, everything kind of remained flat. We'll wait and see what happens. We had an election. We knew who was going to be president. The market jumped up. Now we're waiting to see on tariffs. Is this a permanent thing? Is this a temporary thing? If it's a permanent thing, it's going to be painful. There's no way around that. It's going to be painful for us and for other people because it is not the most efficient way of doing business. If it is a temporary thing, how often is this going to occur and how do you plan a business around it? So that uncertainty is the enemy of any market. You want the most certainty you can get on what pieces you're going to buy so that you can sell something. If you're going to put something together, you want to know what price you should sell it for before you build it. Otherwise, you don't know if you're going to make a profit. Why do you get into a business if you don't know if you're going to make a profit? Well, you might do it if you're willing to take the risk, but that kind of narrows the field for who wants to go into business. That's not cool. I think business field should be open. The more consistency, the better. I don't think that the government should get involved in setting prices, and that's what happens when they set tariffs. And there's my soapbox. I was standing on it for so long enough that my feet are nicely clean.
That's good.
Yeah.
We're optimistic for this year for the market. We continue to be. However, it's a good idea to be aware that there's a series of initiatives that have come out of the White House that conceivably could cause things to fall rather abruptly. So it's a good idea to keep your powder, keep some dry powder, keep your portfolio well balanced. And we kind of suspect that there's going to be a bull market mania kick in sometime in the near future.
Yeah, and let me kind of, we can hit this last minute and a half or so before our close up with some good news. GDP is expected to come up extra high. We've got great unemployment numbers. Personal income rose again. There, it's up 2.7% for year over year. That means that the people that have been complaining about not getting pay raises are getting pay raises, and they're getting them above inflation, which is historically not normal. We've got manufacturing index, the ISM, is up, which means that we've got more manufacturing going on. Non-farm payrolls, we hired 223,000 people in May. That's fantastic. When we look at the leading indicators, there's some tiny pieces that are not positive news, and the rest are really, really positive. So while we've been beating on the tariffs the entire episode for several weeks, it's because we cannot maintain this kind of rosy economy if we impede the very engine of the economy, which is the ability to do business across a global market. And there we go. If you would like to contact us off the air, we're about out of time for this week. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we give fiduciary investment advice, and we manage portfolios for people of high net worth. And you can call us and talk to us individually, and we will give you personalized advice. Locally, there's a number with voicemail during the weekend at
Derek Course, area code 254-947-1111.
And you can reach that same voicemail or real live people toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where there are podcasts and newsletters, philosophy, and our ugly mugs and our wonderful staff. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we read those things and we will answer.